described by energy scattering experiments by perturbation theory. If you then go to lower energies, to the infrared, quarks and gluons get dynamically confined into hadrons, and you cannot apply perturbation theory any longer, so you won't see confinement to any order in perturbation theory. So if you look at the QCD phase diagram and the temperature baryon density plane, then you have deconfined quarks and gluons at high temperatures, and then you have a deconfinement phase transition to the hadronic phase. It's actually accompanied also by a chiral phase transition where the chiral symmetry is broken and hadrons acquire their masses. If you go to very high densities in this phase diagram that are presumably color superconductor phases, you also find neutron stars here, the equation of state of which is essentially still undetermined from first principles. There are still a lot of open questions in the QCD phase diagram. For example, it's not clear if this first order phase transition actually terminates at a critical point here, which is second order, or if there is no such critical point in this phase diagram. Yes?
Going through like volumes of physics at a rapid, rapid rate. So just to slow you down at one point, are you sure that the neutron stars sit near the phase the chiral phase transition?
I mean, so this is really a cartoon. So I think there are higher densities.
No. But that implies that the core of a neutron star is in a deconfining phase, and it seems to me that we don't know that.
So actually, I think the fact that the neutron stars is written over there broadly just tells you that this is a cartoon, and we don't know exactly the location of neutron stars, and we don't know exactly the location of the phase transition, and we don't know how broad it actually really is.
Right. If neutron stars do sit at that phase transition or near that phase transition, there are consequences for astronomical things like the upper mass limit, the softness of the equation of state, or the hardness of the equation of state, and so forth.
Yes, actually, the equation of state of neutron stars is interestingly accessible by gravitational wave astronomy.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting connection of the QCD phase diagram to a completely different area of physics. Okay. So it's also not clear what the relation between chiral symmetry breaking and confinement really is. So here at zero density, the two phase transitions seem to be rather close to each other, but it's not clear if here they are further away from each other, and there may be a phase where you have chiral symmetry restoration but still have confinement. It's not clear if such a phase may exist, and also the physical mechanism of confinement is still not clear. So here we are starting by understanding pure Young-Mills theory, because the gauge bosons actually carry the dynamics of confinement, so we can understand a lot about QCD by just looking at Young-Mills theory and making quarks infinitely heavy. So what I will do in this talk is I will introduce our main tool, namely the functional renormalization group, which allows to do the necessary non-perturbative calculations to access this phase diagram. I will then present results on the confinement phase transition at finite temperature, and finally also on the gluon condensate in Young-Mills theory. So the goal of the functional renormalization group is to evaluate the full quantum effective action, that is the full generating functional, the UV regularized path integral with an exponential of minus the action in the Euclidean case, and we do not want to resort to any perturbative approximation here. So in the non-perturbative regime, there is no small parameter in which we could expand, so we really have to do the full path integral. And the basic idea here is to do the path integral momentum shell-wise, that is integrate out quantum fluctuations in a certain momentum shell, P plus delta P, one after the other. And the way to implement this is to introduce an infrared regulator function, this delta S, and then we have a scale-dependent generating functional. And this regulator function actually has the following form. It's quadratic in the fields, so it acts like a mass for the field, and this regulator function R depends on your regularization scale K and on the momentum P in such a way that if you go to very high momenta, the regulator function actually goes to zero. So this means that these modes do not get this mass-like suppression, and they are integrated out in the path integral. On the other hand, if you go to momenta p squared smaller than k squared, then this regulator term is finite, and this means that these modes acquire a scale-dependent mass, and their fluctuation in the path integral is suppressed, and so they are not integrated out. And if you then lower the scale k successively, you will integrate out the path integral momentum shell-wise. Yes, it's an infrared regulator.
So you also have to worry about the ultraviolet regulator.
I will come to this. So here we just write formally a UV regularized half integral, but I will show you what happens to the UV regularization in a minute. So actually what we look at is the generating function for the one particle irreducible correlation functions, which is the effective average action. It's a modified Meissner transform of this generating functional. And if you go with your scale k to 0, this is the full quantum effective action, which encodes the effect of all quantum fluctuations, and its equations of motion, or its functional derivative gives you the equations of motion, motions of the vacuum expectation values of your field. And now...
Isn't it possible to have some issue with this particular regulator? Because this actually modifies your action. So then you analyze the behavior with this modified action. Are you sure that you can actually, in some sense, commute the pass integral with this regularization procedure? Isn't it possible that your regularized function is actually not the...
You mean this limit here?
Yes, for instance. Because then you kind of commuted the k to 0 with adding this term in the pass integral.
Yes, but I know of no case where this actually does not work in k to the 1. Now the scale dependence of this effective average action is given by the so-called Wetterich equation. And let me explain this. Here on the right-hand side, we have the second functional derivative of the effective average action with respect to the fields. Then you add this mass-like regulator and you form the inverse, and this is nothing but the full non-perturbative field-dependent propagator of the field. You also have the scale derivative of the regulator here, and then the super trace contains an integral over momenta and a trace over Lorentz and internal indices. And so now I come to the question about the UV regularization. This equation is infrared and UV finite. The infrared finiteness is given because you have this mass-like term here, so you always have a mass which is proportional to k squared. It's also UV finite because the scale derivative of the regulator, which you have in the denominator, actually falls off fast enough for large momenta. And so this equation is infrared and UV finite.
Do you mind just saying that slowly?
Okay, so yeah. The scale derivative of the regulator falls off fast for large momenta, and this tells you that you will never have any UV divergences.
The regulator is the red curve.
So the regulator is the red curve.
So it's going to zero. So why isn't its derivative going to a constant, which is not zero?
The k decay of this.
So that should be d by dt or d by d up there, the blue curve.
The dt is actually a k decay. I'm sorry. So the dt, this is k decay of rk, and this is exactly this term here. And so as this goes to zero for high momentum, you have a UV regularization. And then also the scale derivative of the regulator typically is peaked around the scale k squared, and this means that this momentum integral here will receive a dominant contribution from quantum fluctuations around the scale k squared. And this implements this Wilsonian idea of integrating out the path integral momentum shell-wise. So to understand what the Wetterich equation does, we can go to the theory space, which is the infinite dimensional space of all operators that are compatible with the symmetries of the theory, and its axes are labeled by the different couplings. So then the classical or microscopic action is just given by a point. Yes?
Back one. Supposing that your path integral originally has no... You said originally your path integral has some ultraviolet regulation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, none of the formulas you've written make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So assume that it has, say, some lattice regularization. Okay. And assume that it's a theory that doesn't exist in the limit that the regulator is removed.
Mm-hmm.
Say, 5/4 in 4 dimensions or phi anything in 5 dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then is your claim... But let's talk about, say, 5/4 in 4 dimensions. Or let's say 5/6 to make it not perturbatively existing. So 5/6 in 4 dimensions.
Okay.
Is your claim that because of the properties of the blue curve there, you could now take the lattice spacing to zero and start to derive results from 5-6 in four dimensions, even though about its renormalization group behavior, even though that's fictional because there is no theory in 5-6 in four dimensions.
So you can also apply this equation to theories where the perturbative renormalization actually fails. And when you look at perturbation theory, you see that your couplings are non-renormalizable. You can still apply this equation there, and you might see non-trivial fixed points in this case.
You might see non-trivial fixed points, but it might be that 5-6 in four dimensions just doesn't exist. I mean, not every quantum field theory has to be saved by asymptotic safety. Mm-hmm. There might just be some quantum field theories that don't exist.
Well, of course, what this equation will do in theory space is that if you go towards the ultraviolet, you either hit some fixed point, or you will just have a flow that continues forever, and that tells you that your theory is actually non-renormalizable. So this might also be the case. So I'm not quite sure about that. It might happen.
So if you take a theory which does not exist, what you tend to see is that you see that in this gamma key, you try to solve this equation, and you find couplings which blow up very, very fast with K and stuff like that, you know. So you find infinities of couplings and which are all relevant and stuff like that. So it's not the equation by itself you can write it, it's just that you can't find a solution for it.
Yeah, I think maybe your question can be answered here in theory space. So this is exactly what happens if you look at such theories. Then if you try to go to the UV, you will not find a fixed point, but you will just continue flowing in theory space forever and finding possibly divergent couplings or just this fixed point which are not predicted. Yes, but now in the case of Young-Mills theories, we are actually interested in starting with something where we know the classical or microscopic action, and we want to integrate out the quantum fluctuations and go to the infrared. So then what happens if we use the Wetterich equation and integrate out a momentum shell of quantum fluctuations, then we move in theory space, and the Wetterich equation actually gives the vector field. When you integrate it, you find this RG trajectory. And so if you do these RG steps successively, you finally end up with the quantum effect of action at K going to zero, which includes the case of all quantum fluctuations. And so, for example, in the case of Young-Mills theory, you actually start in the vicinity of the Gaussian fixed point in the ultraviolet, and if you then integrate out the quantum fluctuations, you start to move away from the perturbative regime when you go towards the infrared. So the Wetterich equation also has a very useful diagrammatic representation because, as I told you, you have here the full propagator of the theory and you have here a momentum integral. So this gives you nothing but a closed loop but over the full non-perturbative propagator. And this regulator insertion here is denoted by this crossed circle over there. So this looks a lot like Feynman diagrams, but it's not a perturbative Feynman diagram. It's really a diagram with a full non-perturbative propagator. Now, the microscopic or classical action actually does not enter the flow equation. It only enters when you want to integrate the flow, because then you need an initial condition at a UV scale, and then the effective action in the limit K going to zero depends on your microscopic or classical action. The nice thing about this equation is that it's an exact equation, so as it stands here, there are no approximations. It does not rely on the existence of any small parameter, and there are no further terms. It's really exact, and it's just a one-loop equation. But of course, there has to be a drawback about it, and this you can see if you look, for example, at the scale derivative of the two-point function. So to get this, you have to take the second functional derivative of the Wetterich equation with respect to the field, and so from this diagram, you then produce these two, the tadpole diagram and the self-energy diagram. But the vertices that you have here are not perturbative vertices. They are really fully non-perturbative vertices. And, of course, to know them, you have to know the flow equation for the 3- and the 4-point function. And these, again, depend on higher-order correlation functions. And so what happens is that if you write the Wetterich equation for the endpoint correlation functions, you get an infinite tower of coupled differential equations. It's very similar through the Dyson-Schwinger equations hierarchy. And so in order to solve this, you need to truncate your tower and need to make an ansatz for some of the vertices in order to be able to close this. Now, of course, here, where you choose your truncation, you have a big range of applicability, because, of course, you might choose a truncation that is adapted to perturbation theory, and so you can use the Wettrich equation to rederive perturbative results, but you can also choose truncations which are adapted to the strongly interacting regime. So what has been studied, for example, are phase transitions in various physical models. Let me just, as an example, give you the BEC-BCS crossover in an ultra-cold gas of fermionic atoms. It has also been used to study quantum gravity, in particular asymptotic safety, extensively. And, of course, we can apply it to gauge theories. Now, you may, of course, ask, well, how do you test the quality of your truncation? In the case of perturbation theory, you have a very good control because you know that the terms that you are neglecting are small. In the strongly interacting regime, this is generically not the case. But of course, what you can do is that you check the regulator dependence of the result. So in full theory space, the endpoint of your flow will not depend on your regulator, but as soon as you truncate, you will introduce a regulator dependence, and simply the size of the regulator dependence tells you how close you really are to the full result, or if you have included all the important operators in your truncation. Then the second possibility is to simply enlarge your truncation and include further operators and check if your result is convergent under this enlargement of the truncation. Now we are interested in applying the Wettrich equation to gauge theory, so here we go to a gauge fixed formulation where we introduce Padeyev Popov ghosts, and then the Wettrich equation has the following form. You have this closed loop for the gauge field here, and you also have a closed loop for the ghost field.
The term you introduced to regularize your theory is quadratic in the field.
Yes.
So do you have a mass term also for the gauge field?
Yes.
So doesn't that break gauge invariance?
Yes, so you actually, in the gauge field formulation, you have to look at the modified wall identities. So you have the usual wall identities, but the regulator term introduces an additional term. So then you have to look at the modified wall identities and these controls.
And the path integral you are, which gives your flow, it's non-gauge invariant.
Yes, so you are in a gauge fixed formulation.
Okay, so you start by the theory, you gauge fix, then you add the regulator.
Mm-hmm.
So because you are gauge fixed, you don't care that this breaks again the gauge invariance?
Yes.
Okay.
So it's just an additional term in the wall identities. Okay. So let me just make a very short comparison between functional methods and one of the standard tools for Young-Liss theory and QCD in the strongly interacting regime, namely lattice gauge theory. So in lattice gauge theory, you discretize space-time on a discrete lattice. And so in order to get back your continuum formulation, you need to take the continuum limit where you take the lattice spacing to zero and the lattice size to infinity. Also, in lattice gauge theory, fermions are problematic in the sense that simulating fermions simply is computationally expensive. It's also quite a problem to introduce a finite chemical potential, but on the other hand, in lattice gauge theory, you do not have to truncate, you really can simulate full QCD. Now, in functional methods, we are directly in the continuum, we never have to take any continuum limit. We can also implement fermions, in a sense, easily. We do not have the problems that the gauge, that the lattice gauge theory has, but of course here we need to truncate. And so this tells you that lattice gauge theory and functional methods are very nice and complementary methods. And it's very useful to use both of them in infrared Young-Liss theory. So let me now come to some concrete applications, namely the confinement phase transition at finite temperature. So here we go to the finite temperature formalism, where the partition function is given by a path integral where the Euclidean time is compactified on a circle, and the circumference of the circle is simply 1 over the temperature. And then gauge bosons, or bosons in general, have to fulfill periodic boundary conditions, and this tells you that the zeroth component of the momentum actually gets replaced by discrete Matsubara frequencies. So what we're interested in here is to describe quark confinement. But we are still in pure Young-Liss theory, so we do not consider dynamical quarks, we just put a static quark source into the theory. And actually in this limit, the confinement phase transition is related to the breaking of a global symmetry, namely center symmetry. So how can we describe an infinitely heavy quark in Young-Liss theory? Well, its world line is actually related to the Polyakov loop, which is the path ordered exponential of the time integral over the zeroth component of the gauge field. And you take a trace in the fundamental representation and divide it by one over the number of colors. So this Polyakov loop now transforms non-trivially under the center symmetry. So the center consists of all the group elements that commute with all other group elements. So for example, for SUM, the center is simply given by Zn. So that is by all elements which can be written as a unit matrix times the phase vector. Now the Polyakov loop...
Just a
yes?
How do you show that? Is it that the center symmetry is not exponent? Is not something you can reach by exponentiating a small gauge transformation?
So actually, what this is related to? If you look at gauge transformations, which are given. If you make such a gauge transformation, where the gauge transformation that you apply at, one over the temperature, this is what you call a twisted gauge transformation, then you can show that this, I'm sorry,
it's
not very readable. So the gauge transformation at zero is given by the gauge transformation at 1 over t times this element of the center. This is the so-called twisted gauge transformation. And under this, the Polyakov loop will transform in this way. And so this tells us that as soon as the Polyakov loop acquires a non-zero expectation value, then the center symmetry will actually be broken. Now, how is this related to quark confinement? Well, the expectation value of the Polyakov loop is given by the exponential of minus beta times f, where f is the free energy of a static quark. And now if you are in the deconfined phase, the free energy is finite, and so this implies that the Polyakov loop expectation value will be unequal to zero, and so this automatically tells you the center symmetry will be broken. On the other hand, if you are in the confined phase where the free energy has to go to infinity, then the expectation value of the Polyakov loop is zero, and center symmetry is restored. So the center symmetry breaking is reversed from what you are usually used to, because it's broken in the deconfined regime at high temperatures, and it gets restored at low temperatures. Let me just say that as soon as we go to full QCD, where we include dynamical quarks, then these break center symmetry explicitly, and also the Polyakov loop is non-zero in the confined phase, because dynamical quarks can always screen a single quark charge. But here we are in pure Young-Wilks theory, so we have a good order parameter for center symmetry breaking. And our strategy is now the following. We use that not only the expectation value of the Polyakov loop is an order parameter for symmetry, center symmetry breaking, but actually also the Polyakov loop of the expectation value of the gauge field. Because you can show that this is always larger than this, and also this quantity has been shown to go to zero in the confined phase. And so the Polyakov loop of the expectation value of the gauge field is a good order parameter for center symmetry breaking. Now what we do is that we use the flow equation to evaluate the potential for the expectation value of the gauge field. This allows us to determine the expectation value of the gauge field as a function of the temperature, and we then plug it into this order parameter. So you can do this perturbatively. It has been done by Gross, Pisarski, Jaffe, and Weiss in the 80s. So in order to get the effective potential, you consider a constant gauge field configuration, and then the effective potential is just the effective action divided by the volume. And in the one-loop approximation, the effective action is given by the trace of the logarithm of the inverse propagator. And you have this term for the gauge field, and you have this term for the ghost here. Now, the inverse propagators, of course, are just proportional to the momentum squared. Now, we have to evaluate them on a non-trivial background, so they go to the covariant derivative on this background squared. And as we are at finite temperatures, the zeroth component of the momentum is just given by a discrete Matsubara frequency. So if you plug this in, we get the following result. For example, in the case of SU2, where the Polyakov loop is simply a cosine of the gauge field, we see that the effective potential has the minimum here at a value of 0. So this means that the Polyakov loop will be 1, and this means we are in the deconfined phase. So what we would need in order to see confinement is actually that this quantity here is equal to 1/2, because then the cosine will exactly vanish. And if this has to be 1/2, then this means that where we now are at the maximum of the perturbative potential, this should just turn into the minimum. So we see that we cannot get this from the perturbative propagators, so what we really need is the non-perturbative propagators. So the non-perturbative propagators in Landau gauge have been investigated by lattice and also by functional renormalization group methods by a large number of people, and what you see here is that they acquire a non-trivial momentum dependence, and in fact the infrared asymptotics are given by a term which is p squared, which is just the perturbative term, times p squared times a to the power of a critical exponent for the gluon and also for the ghost. And what you actually find from functional methods is that there is a sum rule relating these two critical exponents, and you get a value which is approximately 0.6 for the ghost critical exponent. Now, if you plug this in here, you get that the ghost propagator will go like a 1 over p squared to the 1.6, so it will be more divergent than a simple perturbative propagator. So this is essentially what you see in this plot here, where you see the non-trivial wave function denormalization. For the case of the gluon, you have a p squared to the 1 minus 1.2, so the full propagator will then go to 0 in the infrared. And so this tells you that the naive picture of infrared slavery, where quarks are confined because the gluon propagator is strongly divergent, is actually not true. The important thing about these propagators in the infrared is that they satisfy the so-called Kugo-Ojima-Kala confinement criterion. This is a formal criterion that tells you that in order to have confinement, all your states in the physical Hilbert space have to be colorless glue balls and not colored gluons. And Kugo and Ojima were able to show that in order for this to happen, the ghost propagator actually has to be more divergent than a simple perturbative propagators. And so you see that these propagators that you get from the functional methods actually fulfill the Kugo-Ojima-Kala confinement criterion. That means they tell you that in the infrared, you will not see deconfined free gluons. You will just see colorless glue balls. Do you have a question?
Value the Wilson loops in the propagators?
So the strategy here is we want to access this quantity. So we need this expectation value, and this we get from evaluating the effective potential. And in the flow equation, we need the gamma 2, which is the inverse propagator.
I just want to understand that step, because somehow the Wilson loop, which is a very non-perturbative thing, you start with your computing the expectation value of the Wilson loop. And we know from lattice gauge theory that that behaves in a way which is very strongly interacting in QCD. In Yang-Mills theory, it's very non-perturbative. And by the step of not evaluating the expectation value of the Wilson loop, but evaluating basically the exponential of the expectation value of the propagator, now you're saying the expectation value of the propagator is evaluated
This is not the propagator, this is the gauge field.
This gauge field. You're saying that that is evaluated, but just from the propagator.
This is evaluated because what you need to evaluate is the full non-perturbative potential, and there you need the non-perturbative propagators. So if you just use the perturbative propagators, you will not see confinement.
Why are properties of the propagators? There's still just two-point functions, even if they're quote non-perturbative two-point functions. There's still just two-point functions. Why are they sufficient to understand the behavior of the Wilson loop?
Because in the flow equation, the only thing you need is just the full propagator.
No, but just if I write down the expectation value of a Wilson loop and think about it perturbatively, physically, there's a term with a gluon exchanged across the loop, there's a term with three gluons exchanged interacting in the middle, a term with four gluons touching the loop, interacting in the middle, it's summed up all to an infinite number of gluons. So it's a highly strongly coupling non-perturbative thing. The claim is, and you're not evaluating that, okay? So you claim that it's sufficient for the purposes of the phase diagram to evaluate, I just want to understand the logic, to evaluate the exponential of the integral of A.
Yes. So here we will not be able to really access the polyhyper group. We will just access this quantity, which is also an order parameter. So from that, we can access the critical temperature, for example.
And the claim is that,
I think, yeah,
where does that inequality come from?
Hmm?
There's an inequality there. Where does that inequality come
from? Yes, this is just because generally, if you just plug it in here, if you just plug the expectation value in here, then if you look at the...
But I don't understand, both of them are cosines, so both of them could be positive or negative. So how is it that there's an inequality between them? I'm not saying you're wrong. It's not obvious.
An easy way to see. Well, this is called the it's named the Jensen inequality. No, it's really just the expectation values. But we are generally looking at the regime where both of these quantities are positive.
So this is a Wilson loop in the Euclidean theory. So
in finite direction.
Right. So, but there's still an e to the i. Or there's no. It's still. I mean, you had on the next slide. It is still a cosine.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, but that's the crux of the magic by which you do. You just study a property of the propagator, and you use it to evaluate a property of the Wilson loop. Okay, and the claim is that. Okay, so go. Sorry to slow you down, but there's a lot of physics in this.
Yes.
So then you evaluate the effective potential. The effective potential is a trace of a log of the.
Yes.
That's standard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You evaluate it. That's an expression you might get for it. Okay, and then. And then how from this are you going to see, if it vanishes, then center symmetry is restored. If it doesn't vanish, that's what you're going to vanish.
Yes, this is what's happening.
Okay,
so now if we evaluate just with the perturbative propagators, we will just see the deconfined regime. And this we will see the regime where actually the minima are here at 0 or 1, and the polyhyper loop is 1 or minus 1, so center symmetry is simply broken. And this tells us that we will not see confinement from the perturbative propagators. So we really need information on the non-perturbative propagators. And this is what we have from functional methods. And then we can use the flow equation to, again, determine the effective potential. And if we use the full flow equation, we get also a trace of the logarithm of the inverse propagator, but this time the full non-perturbative propagator. And there are actually also correction terms, namely the scale derivative of the inverse propagator, which you might call an RG improvement term, and there is also a term which is related to the back coupling of the potential. Now, what we actually observe is that the potential is driven by modes which have momenta around the temperature scale. So that means that if you go to very, very low temperatures, then the propagators that enter these expressions here will be the infrared asymptotic propagators. And these, I just told you, have this behavior that they go as a d squared times a critical to the power of a critical exponent. And yes, as you have this trace of the logarithm, you can just pull this in front, and you have a 1 plus critical exponent trace logarithm of the covariant derivative squared. And this actually allows you to determine a confinement criterion. Namely, the effective potential in the limit where the temperature goes to 0 is then given by this trace logarithm d squared terms. And here you have what comes from the infrared asymptotic scaling, one factor for the ghost, for the longitudinal gluons, and also for the transversal gluons. And now this expression, this trace of logarithm of d squared, is nothing but the perturbative effective potential. And as I just showed you, this perturbative effective potential has this form where it has a maximum at the value which would correspond to a confining to a confining potential. So what we want is that we just invert this potential, because then the minimum is at a value of a half, and there the polyhyper loop will vanish. And this tells us that this factor here in front of the trace logarithm term actually has to be smaller than 0 in order for this to happen. And now you can look at it, for example, in 4 dimensions, and there it simply reduces to such an inequality. And if you then plug in the values for the critical exponents from the Landau gauge propagators, you see that this inequality is satisfied. And so here's the non-trivial thing, that the gluon and the ghost propagator that encode the property of color confinement, that is, they encode the property that gluons themselves are confined, they induce a quark confining order parameter potential. And this, indeed, as you observed, is quite a surprising thing, because this allows you to access confinement purely from the knowledge of gauge correlation functions without any knowledge, for example, about the quark gluon vertex. So what we would like to do now is to really observe the phase transition as a function of the temperature. So we evaluate the effective potential as a function of the temperature, which I indicate here by these different colors. And so what happens if you lower the temperature is that the minimum starts to move in here and slowly moves towards larger values of the gauge field. If you translate this into the Polyakov loop of the expectation value, then this means that this will slowly go from 1 down all the way to 0, and as the minimum here moves smoothly, you will not have a jump in the Polyakov loop, but it will go continuously to 0, and so you will have a second-order phase transition for SU2, which is in agreement with what we know from lattice calculations. In the lattice theory, they really access the expectation value of the Polyakov loop, and so you compare this, and what you actually see is that the nth inequality is satisfied, because typically the expectation value of the Polyakov loop on the lattice goes much slower to a value of 1 than in our case. But the critical temperatures, if we convert them to a dimension S number in order to compare with the lattice, then we see that the critical temperature here is it's close, but it's not the same. And we can trace this back to the fact that in the effective potential, we actually take the trace logarithm terms into account. We also take this RG improvement term into account, which actually just makes a variation of about 10% of the whole result, so it's very small. The main contribution comes from these terms, but we currently neglect the backcoupling of the potential. And now if you have a second order phase transition where long-range correlations are important, you can imagine that the second derivative of the effective potential will play an important role. And so we expect that this deviation from the lattice result will improve if we include this term here. Now let me go to the case of SU3, which is the case that is actually realized in nature. And it's a string tension. So just you can use any quantity that allows you to convert it to a dimensionless unit, but less people typically plot everything over the string tension. So in the case of SU3, what happens for the effective potential is that the global minimum also starts to move in towards larger values of the gauge field here, but a second local minimum forms at larger values and it moves down, and so at the critical temperature, the global and the local minimum will be of the same height, and then the expectation value of the gauge field will jump to this global minimum here, and this is where the Polyakov loop actually vanishes. And so in the case of SU3, you see that we have a first-order phase transition with a finite jump for the Polyakov loop. This is also in agreement with lattice results, and here the critical temperature is very close to the lattice critical temperature, and this confirms our expectation that this term, which corresponds to the backcoupling of the potential, will be important for second-order phase transitions, but will not be so important for first-order phase transitions. So now we saw two gauge groups with two different orders of the phase transition, and we might try to understand what actually determines the order of the phase transition. So why did we see second order for SU2 but first order for SU3? So there's a conjecture by Svetitsky and Jaffe from 1982 that says that if the phase transition is of second order, then the center determines the universality class. And to understand this conjecture, imagine that in the path integral, you integrate out all fields except the ones that correspond to the Polyakov loop. You will then end up with the scalar field theory, which is actually one dimensional lower than the original Young-Mills theory, because the Polyakov loop already contains an integral over the time. And the symmetry of the scalar field theory is the center symmetry under which the Polyakov loop transforms non-trivially. And so this means that you will have the scalar theory in one dimension and lower. And if you then have a second order phase transition, then the complicated microscopic dynamics of this theory will not be important, but what will determine the universality class is only the field content, the symmetries, and the dimensionality. And so this conjecture tells you that in SU2, in four dimensions, you should expect the critical exponents of the three-dimensional Ising universality class. But what you then observe on the lattice gauge theory is that different gauge groups all have first-order phase transition apart from SU2. And so that means that the gauge theories somehow do not make use of the available universality classes. Now, there's an argument that suggests how you can understand this. It says that the mismatch in the number of dynamical degrees of freedom is responsible for the order of the phase transition. So what is meant by that? On the deconfined phase side of the phase transition, the dynamical degrees of freedom are the free gluons. On the confined phase, they are the glue balls. And the number of glue balls is essentially independent of the size of the gauge group, whereas the number of gluons depends on the size of the gauge group. So if you crank up the size of the gauge group, you will have very many deconfined gluons and the same number of glue balls. And so you will have a large mismatch in the number of dynamical degrees of freedom. And then the argument simply says that for such a large mismatch, you should not expect that physics makes a continuous transition from one regime to the other. And this would tell you that you should expect a first-order phase transition for large gauge groups. So we looked at this with our method. So we investigated gauge groups SUM for n equals 2 to 12. And what you observe here is that, indeed, we have a first-order phase transition for n larger than 2 in agreement with the lattice results, which are available up to n equals 8. And you see that nothing more exciting happens if you go to SU9 or SU10. We also observe that the critical temperature and the height of the jump essentially are independent of n for n larger than 8. So this is what you would also expect from the large n limit. We then looked at the case of the symplectic group SP2. Now, why is this an interesting case? It's not interesting because we expect this to be realized in nature, but this gauge group has the same universality class available for a second order phase transition as SU2, namely Z2. But on the other hand, its number of generators is similar to SU3, where you have a first-order phase transition. And so this tells you that you should expect a first-order phase transition for SP2. And this is indeed what we observe here. So this tells me that we have a gauge group where we have a universality class available for a second-order phase transition, but the large number of dynamical degrees of freedom on the deconfined side of the phase transition drives it to a first-order phase transition. The same can be observed in the case of E7, which also has a center Z2, so a second-order phase transition available, but it has a huge number of generators, namely 133, which makes a large mismatch. And so you would expect a first-order phase transition, and indeed we observe a first-order phase transition, but surprisingly we observe that this phase transition, that the phase transition is much weaker first-order than, for example, in the case of SU12. We can actually understand this from our method, but since I'm running out of time, I would prefer to say something on the gluon condensate in Young-Mills theories. So the perturbative vacuum with a vanishing value of the field strength is unstable in Young-Mills theory, and indeed you expect a non-trivial vacuum structure with a non-trivial vacuum expectation value for the field strength. Calculation of the one-loop effective action actually shows just the formation of such a non-trivial minimum, which corresponds to the formation of a gluon condensate in the vacuum. This one-loop effective action calculation, however, has two problems. Namely, Zavidi used a covariantly constant color magnetic background field configuration, and this configuration itself is unstable. So if you look at perturbations or fluctuations around this background, you observe a tachyonic mode, which tells you that this configuration will decay. Now, you can amend this problem by introducing what is called the Copenhagen vacuum, where you have just finite-sized regions of covariantly constant magnetic field, So you can think of it similar to the Weiss domains in a magnet. A much more severe problem is that the minimum here, which Davide observed, actually lies beyond the perturbative domain. So the one loop effective action tells you that you might expect the formation of a minimum, but in the interesting regime, the calculation breaks down. However, such a gluon condensate is physically very interesting, because if you consider the simple-minded leading log model for the effective potential, which just incorporates the leading logarithmic corrections to the potential and is of a form f squared times the logarithm of f squared, then you can look at a static quark-antiquark pair on this background, and what you actually can see is that there's a linearly growing quark potential between them. So the property of QCD that we observe here is that if you pull apart a quark-antiquark pair, then you get a flux tube forming between them with a constant energy density, so a linearly rising potential. And then, of course, what happens in full QCD with dynamical quarks is that if there is enough energy in the string, you have a dynamical formation of a new quark-antiquark pair, and they bound to two mesons. So this string-breaking process leads to a flattening of the quark potential in QCD, and this is, of course, something that we cannot observe here in Young-Mills theory of static quarks. We can just observe this first part of the linearizing potential, and Adler and Piran actually showed that in this leading log model, the string tension, which characterizes this process, is related to the expectation value of the field strength squared.
What is this?
So this is just a model. It just says we know that the leading corrections will presumably be of this form. We just make a model that the effective action looks like that, and then we investigate what happens if we put a static quark-antiquark pair into this model. And so now we are interested in evaluating the effective potential from the flow equation. So we again generalize the Landau-gauge propagators to a non-trivial background. So then the propagator on this background is given by the Landau-gauge propagator evaluated on a suitable covariant Laplace-type operator. And there are additional terms which depend on the field strength. These were not there in the case of the Polyakov loop calculation, because there the background field configuration has a vanishing field strength. And we cannot determine these terms from the knowledge of the pure two-point functions alone. They depend on higher order correlation functions. And here we do a minimal reconstruction by setting the Laplace type operator for the transverse gluon to a d squared, plus this term which is proportional to the field strength. But in this reconstruction, there are still operators that are missing. So we do not expect that our results will be quantitatively precise. We have then specialized in the case of a self-dual background, and we need the spectra of these covariant Laplace type operators in order to evaluate the flow equation, and these have been evaluated by Leufield in 1980. So what we find then is that we evaluate, if we integrate the effective potential, starting at an initial UV scale of 10 GeV, where we are well within the perturbative regime, and the starting point for our effective potential is just the perturbative effective potential. If we then integrate out the flow equation, we observe indeed the formation of a non-trivial minimum, and the vacuum expectation value of the field strength is proposed is given by 0.93 GeV to the 4, and indeed this is a bit higher than what you observe from phenomenological estimates, but as I just told you, as we do an approximation in the reconstruction of the full propagators, we do not expect to be quantitatively precise. The surprising thing about our result to us was that we can qualitatively fit the effective potential approximately rather well by the simple f squared logarithm of f squared term. So this tells us that the simple-minded leading log model actually qualitatively matches the physics that we observe when we calculate the full effective potential. And this tells us that if we will include a quark-antiquark pair in here, they will have a linearly rising potential, and we can determine the string tension between them from this minimum, and we find a value of 747 MeV. So you have to compare this to the true value of 440 MeV, so you see that we are still a bit off, but as I told you, we do several approximations, so we do not expect to find the correct value. The surprising thing is that we indeed confirm that the leading log model seems to be qualitatively correct. So let me now summarize. I try to convince you that functional renormalization group methods provide a very useful tool to access the non-perturbative regime of QCD and Young-Mills theory. In particular, I showed you results on the deep and Feynman phase transition, where we can relate the gluon and Gauss propagators to the Polyakov loop, and we find that indeed the color confining gluon and Gauss propagators give rise to a confining Polyakov loop potential. We then also saw that the mismatch in the number of dynamical degrees of freedom seems to be the one that determines the order of the phase transition, and so we observed a first order phase transition for all gauge groups that we studied except SU2. Finally, I also showed you the formation of a gluon condensate in the Young-Mills vacuum, which actually gives rise to a linearizing quark potential. So to give a short outlook about the things that we plan to do next, is we want to calculate thermodynamics properties such as pressure and entropy density on the deconfined side of the phase transition. We would also like to go away from four dimensions and actually see if we can determine a critical size of the gauge group as a function of the dimensionality for which the phase transition will be of first order. We will then also study center-free gauge groups, for example, the exceptional group G2, where you do not have any symmetry that is broken, but still lattice simulations suggest that you observe a crossover from a confined to a deconfined regime. And finally, we would also improve our approximations in the calculation of the gluon condensate and actually also study the temperature-dependent formation of the gluon condensate and relate this to the calculation of the temperature-dependent phase transition. So thank you very much for your attention.
I have two questions. The first question is about the fact that in both calculations, first you were talking about the Polyakov loop, then about the gluon condensate, and in both cases you compute an effective potential. So why does, and in the second case, the effective potential indicates that there is a gluon condensate, right? Mm-hmm. Why don't you also see that, could you in principle see that also in the first calculation?
Well, so in the second calculation, we really have to evaluate the effective potential as a function of the field strength spread. And in the first calculation, we use a background field configuration, which is just a constant A0 field, so this is a vanishing field strength. So that's why we cannot see it there. But in principle, the idea
is...
So
you're computing the full effective potential in the first case, or what does it mean you're...
So we are just computing the effective potential for such a gauge configuration. So in this case, we are simply neglecting terms that we have to put in here.
But that's just the background field, so you do allow fluctuations around this background, A0.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
It's just an order term.
Mm-hmm. And the other question is, you chose the Polyakov loop. Have you guys also tried to compute directly the Wilson loop at zero temperature? Or is there a reason why this is not done or complicated?
So the primary goal of this year is to finally access the phase diagram of QCD. And so for this, we need to access the order parameters, and we are interested in things like the formation of the gluon condensate.
Confinement at zero temperature, right? That's which you apparently do. Has anybody tried to compute the Wilson loop with these functional randomization methods?
No, but in principle it should be possible. But I mean, from the Polyakov loop, we do get the confining potential at temperature equals to zero. So we do get confinement at T equals to zero.
So you mentioned that it's easy to do chiral fermions. Because that's certainly very difficult with lattice. Are you planning to go ahead and do that, or somebody?
So actually, part of the people that were involved here, namely Jens Braun and Jan Pawlowski, are working on the QCD side of this together with Lisa Haas, and they have what they have done until now is access the QCD phase diagram for an imaginary chemical potential. Because this is where you can compare it to lattice simulations, because they can do imaginary chemical potential. And now that they have precision there, they can also access real chemical potential. And so, yes, so there's work going on there.
Thanks very much.
Other questions? So let's thank Astrid.